Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
My goal was to, cut down the fat on my body. I'm not sure exactly where I was at first, but, I felt like I made a big change with my body, my weight. And, just this offseason, I'm just focused on trying to, I felt like my knee had made a lot of progression from, when I first started playing and until the end of the season. But then, I knew that I needed to do a little more, strengthening and, just maintenance stuff after the season. So, I'm still just trying to stay on top of it, make sure I'm just ready for, to help this team win games. So, like I said, I'm feeling great. My body feeling great. My knee feeling great. So,
first off, it definitely had to be like just try to get in the best shape ever, be able to go through the entire game, make my routes look the same. So I definitely got to be well conditioned, and that's exactly what we preach on here with the Titans. That's a key thing with Coach Braves. So,
good morning, Nashville. You're listening to Morning Drive live from the Wholesale Link Studio, powered by RumbleOn.com. Justin Bradford, Joe Rexroad, Marquise Munson, and you just heard from Jeffrey Simmons and A.J. Brown of the Tennessee Titans, both poised for tremendous year two breakouts coming up this season. A.J. Brown had a great, great rookie year, and you even have James Jones saying that he is predicting that A.J. Brown will lead the NFL in receiving yards and touchdowns next season. And then you have the NFL Network analysts are saying that Jeffrey Simmons is poised for the number one rank overall in terms of breakouts for year two. Joe, looking at this, just because you've been around this so much longer, just what you heard from Jeffrey Simmons and what he did in his debut in the middle of the season last year, are these expectations for him having a tremendous year two breakout good?
Yeah, no, I think they're reasonable. I think he pretty amazing what he was able to do, honestly. When you think about an ACL, I know ACLs are not what ACLs used to be. You might be done for your career. And now a lot of guys come back as good as ever. But big guys like that, to come back as quickly as he did, I think that's pretty impressive. And some of what he did last year, there were some moments where it was just – it was just an overpowering moments for him on that field, including goal line stand against the Chargers, where he just blew up a play. In the future, Jeffrey Simmons against Quentin Nelson, the Colts, that's something I'm very much looking forward to watching. So I think the Titans moving Jarrell Casey tells you what they think. I don't think that move is made if they don't feel like a healthy Jeffrey Simmons is a big difference maker in the middle of the line. I could still argue, what about those two together and another year as an apprentice to Jarrell Casey? Because I thought maybe that could be a strength of this defense, even though Casey is not the player he was a few years ago. But still, I thought that could have been a strength. It's not the case. I think it speaks to what they think of Jeffrey Simmons.
And obviously cleared up some cap.
Yeah, right. Which is no doubt.
Pretty important, yeah. Too. So, and Jeffrey Simmons noted, too, that he wasn't comfortable playing as heavy as he was, and he took on a big thing with nutrition to try and get rid of some fat. He said weight at first, but made sure it was fat and not muscle and everything, too. It appears to be in outstanding shape, which is even better. If you have a guy that's a little bit leaner, which can add to that explosiveness, especially on the defensive line, too. Him just overall saying that, I think, is impressive to say that he's taking that into account because he wants to be better, because he already was good. Now he can just keep getting better.
Yeah, and his snap count's going to go way up. So conditioning and stamina are going to be huge for him this year. I think he's going to play a massive increase of snaps per game compared with what he did last year. He had some games last year where he got a lot of snaps, but he's going to be – he's the focal point of that defensive line now. And, again, Daquan Jones always gets underrated. Daquan Jones, a really good player, and he's a key part of that line too. And then there's a lot of – other guys that they're right now hoping to step up. But Simmons has got to be in great shape. And based on some pictures we've seen on social media, it looks like he really got some work done during the offseason. So that's great for the Titans, great for him.
And that's all we pretty much have seen is pictures on social media.
It's that and Zoom, you know, some Zoom calls. And, yeah, I mean, that's a funny thing. Like the Titans offseason awards, Mike Vrabel was talking about it. Mike Vrabel talks today, later, by the way, but he was talking about those last week. I'm trying to remember. Rashard Davis was definitely one of them. I think Logan Woodside, too. But it was, I mean, it was largely based on, like, Zoom stuff and I guess attentiveness, questions you ask. I don't know. I mean, there's just some things. In a normal year, it's like, hey, look at them work out and what are they doing? And now it's sort of like pretty sure they're working out well. And we, you know, there's the program you give them and you can monitor to some extent. But a lot of it is these conversations. So the conversation with Jeffrey Simmons yesterday was very much, I thought he was really good and he was kind of a little bit outspoken about what his goals are, and he seemed a lot more comfortable. And he's going to be not just a guy on the field, he's going to be a guy off the field everyone wants to talk to. He is now stepping into this bigger role as a, not a face of this team, but he's one of the frontline guys now for the Titans.
And as is
A.J. Brown.
Right, and to be a leader as well, because you spoke about being a leader in the community and being very involved in the community, and that's when he was asked about Jarrell Casey as well, how important he was to the community. That's one of the things he learned in a very short amount of time, obviously, 1 year, from Jarrell Casey, is being a leader in the community too. So it's good to hear athletes talk about that and understand that it's not just about the product on the field, it's about what your role in the community too when you're a professional athlete. That's big to me when I hear him say that. So
yeah, it's good to say that. And Jarrell Casey talked it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Walked it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was really, really a big part of that for a lot of years here.
And so before we move on to A.J. Brown, what's a reasonable expectation in terms of number of sacks, do you think, for Jeffrey Simmons? He had two last year. What in terms of moving up for him to make that impact and replace and continue to move up for this defensive line, what's reasonable?
Yeah, I don't know. Sack number, you know, he could have two or three sacks this year and still be a dominant, great player and help others get the sacks. Certainly it'd be great if he could get home and get five or six. I mean, mm-hmm. That'd be great. You know, he's got to disrupt consistently, command two blockers, which I believe he will consistently, and then other people have got to take advantage of that. Yeah, you get interior rush, and it's been talked about with Tom Brady for years. When has he struggled the most when teams have been able to get at him with interior pass rush? That's the same is true for a lot of quarterbacks. So, yeah, I don't know if there's a – you know, again, I like Jadeveon Clowney. Mm-hmm. The big knock on him last year is three sacks. I think Corey Curtis said yesterday. There's more to that, though. Even in a banged-up, not great year for him, he still had impact in a lot of ways without actually getting home. You want to get home, if you're going to be a big money players, especially on the outside, you have to show a number. But Simmons can not have numbers and still be a star. I mean, that's, you know, that's the nature of that position.
And speaking of star, A.J. Brown as well had a fantastic rookie season. And then as we enter this segment, James Jones explain on NFL Network why he thinks A.J. Brown will be the leader, not just only in receiving yards, but also in touchdowns. Is that a reasonable expectation for A.J. Brown to have that? And the reason why I asked too is I think it is because you have Derrick Henry. That's obviously going to have a major effect on this as well because it's going to make – defense is questioned so much, and A.J. Brown's going to get a lot of one-on-one. So is it a reasonable expectation that he could lead the league in receiving yards and touchdowns?
I think that's a little shooting high, just by the nature of the offense. You know, I think a lot of the touchdowns will go to Derrick Henry. I think that when there is extra coverage, I think it'll go to A.J. Brown. So now Derrick Henry makes it easier on a guy like A.J. Brown, naturally, but when teams are going to bracket a receiver, who are they going to do? Who are they going to send their best cornerback to if they're going to travel with them? It's going to be A.J. Brown. And we saw that last year against the Saints and some of the games late in the season where, you know, he needs to get better at handling that. And the Titans probably need to, you know, Ryan Tannehill probably needs to get better at just letting it rip to him some too. But I think that's a little bit unrealistic. I just don't think this offense is going to be winging around to that extent where he would have numbers like that. I could be wrong. I mean, look, teams stack the box against Derrick Henry anyway. So it's not like that's going to be new. but I just I wonder if there's even more to come of that until the Titans. Well, the Titans did demonstrate last year that it doesn't work. That's why their offense was so effective. I mean, it was just really a pick-your-poison type deal with a lot of these defenses down the stretch. So I think A.J. Brown will have a really good year. I think 1,000-plus, you know, maybe 80-catch, 1,200-plus kind of season, maybe 1,500. But I think some of the guys out there might have bigger numbers than that. Which is fine with the Titans, as long as the numbers are, you know, if they can score around 30 a game like they were doing the second half of last year, you know, they're happy with that.
And that'd still be a great year, too, for them, for sure.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And Corey Davis, you know, is still a guy I look at, if he can be healthy, who can benefit from all of this, because A.J. Brown is now the top guy on the scouting report and, well, the top guy catching the ball. Derrick Henry, people know Jonnu Smith is dangerous. Corey Davis is going to have opportunities to be one-on-one with guys and make plays.
All right, we're going to continue our football talk. Back to college football. Booger McFarland had some strong takes on college football. We'll listen to that and discuss that next. Morning Drive with Justin Bradford, Joe Rexroad, Marquise Munson, ESPN 102.5 The Game.
The college football season should be canceled. It should be canceled today. And I don't take any pleasure in saying that. You know that I've spoken at Alabama. I've spoken at Clemson. I've spoken at various universities throughout the last year. Paul, you know what I do. At the end of the day, I'm a staunch supporter of moving forward, recognizing the seriousness of a situation, but understanding the economic impact. And religiously, I've been of the position that you move full steam ahead. You just exhaust safety protocols. That all goes out the window with college football, because college football is inept. It's incompetent. It's devoid of leadership, damn near morals, as far as I'm concerned, and they're getting exactly what they deserve. I predict, Paul Feinbaum and Max Kellerman, that because of what we're witnessing transpire before our very eyes right now, you will ultimately see some kind of student-athlete association. You will see representation received on the part of student-athletes in the future. Because when you are a sport of this magnitude, raking in hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, and you don't have one definitive leader to lean on that everyone has to answer to, that has some sense of organization and structure, that is definitely looking out for the student athlete, when you don't have that going on and they're not getting paid, you've got yourself a problem.
Made this here with all the ice on in the booth. At the gate outside, when they pull up, they give me loose. Yeah, jump out.
Welcome back to Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Justin Bradford, Joe Rexroad, Marquise Munson behind the glass. A very strong opinion from Booger McFarland there, and I remember hearing that live, and you could tell. Sorry, Stephen A. You could tell. I'm sorry, I was going by the sheet, man. My bad.
There's Booger to come.
Yeah, Booger to come. But to hear the powerful take right there, you can see how there's passion behind that. And I get it. I get it as well. I understand, because everyone has their strong opinions on this. And like we said very early on in the show, I understand both sides. I completely understand both sides and why they feel like they need to play and why others feel like they don't need to be playing. Because what can happen, Joe?
Yeah, and again, it comes down to it's the model of, you know, these are not laborers. These are college students and bula bula, and they're just playing a sport, and, you know, it's amateurism and good old college competition. I mean, that's still basically the argument of leadership in college athletics who have tried at every turn to keep them from obvious things that should be available to them. And that's now been taken out of their hands because states have started to pass these rights. I mean, so this is largely the amateurism model, again, just being exposed for what it is. It's ridiculous. Because if you could collectively bargain with these players and say, okay, this, just like the professional leagues, and say, okay, this, these are our protocols, so do you agree to this? Okay, then what do you want? Let's go back and forth. Let's figure something out, and we agree, and we move forward. But the bottom line is that these presidents fear class action lawsuits down the road, especially if, you know, this myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart, is something. I don't know if it is or not. I know that there are studies and that there are some players now, five in the Big Ten, according to ESPN, who have reported some kind of heart issues after recovering from COVID-19. So that aspect is probably, some people are still going to frame this as like the death rate for young people, which is very low. Although I also will tell you this, if one person, young person were to die, then that's also obviously a complete game changer. And there have been young people who have died of COVID-19. As far as was known, did not have underlying conditions.
Right.
So it's still a random virus that strikes people very differently.
And we've seen plenty of times, too, in college sports that players might have an underlying condition that's not discovered
that we don't know
until later, that maybe this virus exposes on them, that they just didn't know that it existed there, too. So plenty of the unknown. Now, here's the clip from Booger McFarland.
But if you're really going to do the right thing by these kids, if you're really going to do what's right, then I think they're either going to postpone it or cancel football. Now, to the point that you asked Dan Greeny about, what if you had a son?
Mm-hmm.
I'll answer that, and I'll take it to another level. I have a son. If he was old enough to play college football and if he was on a team, I wouldn't let him play, because here's the thing that I would ask, and here's the statement I've been saying for months. How can it be safe for me to send my 17 to 20-year-old son on the field, but you can't have fans in the stands? How can it be safe for me to send my 17 to 20-year-old kid to college, but you can't have kids that go to class and sit in these seats? See, at some point, this has become selfish for everyone else, and we want to make decisions when we're not the one that's taking all the risks. The kids are the one that's taking the risk, and unfortunately for the NCAA and for college football and for college athletics, we still call these kids amateur athletes, and we've hid behind that for years. Well, guess what? That's kind of biting us in the rear end now, because you have amateur athletes that can't make these decisions. I understand what Trevor Lawrence and all these people around the country are doing. We want to play. Well, guess what? It's not up to you, because you're an amateur. What does that mean? That means somebody's got to make this decision for you. This is not professional football where you're dealing with grown men. This is not the professional ranks where you're getting paid millions of dollars and you can make that decision on your own. These are amateur athletes, and somebody's got to make that decision. So I understand we want to play. I understand the hashtag. That doesn't really mean anything, because you can't make the decision for yourself. And if it was my son, Greeny, we're not playing, because if we can't have fans in the stands, if we can't go to class, if we can't be a regular student, then why in the hell are we playing football? I'll tell you why, Greeny. We're playing because the fans, the people that work around college football, the people that work in this industry, we are selfish because economically it impacts us. And that's the only reason we're still trying to get this season off the ground.
Made some long, strong points there.
Yeah, he made some strong points. I don't like the fans in the standpoint, though, because, look, the bottom line is the people who are participating in the game are treated differently. I mean, even if you don't have a bubble, and we can't, and that's the only thing that we know would work, but even without a bubble, we're talking about way more testing and the protocols and all these things for the people participating in the games. I mean, the fans in the stand thing is to not spread it, to have that. I mean, like, I don't like that link. I think there's a difference there. Now, the question is, could you have some kind of a bubble situation if you didn't have this ridiculous amateurism thing where the players don't have a voice? Then maybe you could have, you know? And look, right now, these players are talking, the We Want to Play hashtag, about forming some kind of a – it can't really be a union, okay? The Northwestern tried to do this, Northwestern players, in 2014. That was mostly about health protocols. Mm-hmm. A lot of that was around concussions. And the National Labor Relations Board rejected them. And, you know, essentially the problem with players organizing in college athletics is that most of college football players play at public universities. They don't play for private companies, okay? And so that's how a union's defined. So, but you could still form a group, some sort of a nonprofit group, and then I would think that the leadership in college football or college athletics would want to speak with you and work with you, and you could still potentially foster something out of that. Because it's like, are the players willing to go to the extent of, okay, we're united, we want to play, let's talk and sit at the table, and then the presidents come back and say, okay, well, this is what we're worried about, I mean, everybody's going to sit here and talk in college athletics and say, we're worried about safety. And that, I'm not saying they aren't, but the university presidents are worried about class action lawsuits that happen down the road because of these things. That is absolutely the bottom line here. So could you get to the point where a discussion leads to some kind of agreement, some kind of waiver, like really comprehensive waiver? They tried to these sort of waivers. They put out the players' sign. Right. They weren't really, you know, they weren't ironclad. And I don't know if there is an ironclad waiver. But to me, again, the pro sports, why do they do it? Because here's your labor force. And, oh, now we're going to give you extra money because we're doing this. Let's negotiate everything.
They have a full collective bargaining agreement that details so many things.
Yeah.
With it.
You can't. So right now you can't do that in college athletics. So even though the players say we want to play, then the next question is, okay, well, how far are you willing to go to play?
Right. Now, Booger followed up with a tweet that says, if players really want to play, which I have no doubt they do, them and their family should sign a waiver releasing all liability related to COVID-19. And at that point, all these conversations about not playing would cease and we would have a college football season. Kind of like what we've been talking about, but is there an ironclad waiver that's going to do this? They're highly unlikely because some lawyer would find some loophole if something happened.
But I think you're probably right. Now, I think there will be a balance of things. You brought it up earlier. How many donors are like, you're taking college football away, Mr. President of the university?
Taking my money away.
Yeah. Okay. I can do a lot of different things with my money. How much does that come into this? I mean, the players' voices matter here. The coaches' voices matter here. The money people, that's a part of this story that I would be interested to know more about with some of these Power Five schools, and I would be willing to bet there are some conversations happening to that effect.
And made a point earlier about public opinion. Since it can't be an actual union, then that's where if it's a nonprofit, some sort of group where they have a voice, it's going to be on the players to sway public opinion. You get the public behind you, which includes donors, which includes people that are watching on TV, that are reading articles, that are buying tickets, that are doing everything they can to support college athletics. You get the public behind you on that, it forces university presidents to listen. This is not even just about the situation right now with COVID-19. This is for the future of college athletics. If you really want to have a voice, sway the public opinion, which we're already seeing now. Leaders are stepping up from these college football teams are stepping up to voice their opinion, and people are listening. They're listening to them. Whether they agree or not, they're listening because it's on social media, and you can't avoid it. And that's the important part of this.
Yeah, and listen, like there are athletes, they have these advisory committees with athletes, right? And they sort of take their advice. Okay, thanks, Johnny. And now, okay, you go over there and we'll make a decision. Well, the result, two things to result of this. One is actual name, image, likeness, freedom, and free market. I mean, you know, like a robust ability to benefit while you're in college. And then two, this actual seat at the table. Again, it can't be. I mean, it's a completely different system if they're actually in a union and they're employees. It just changes. It doesn't exist anymore. College sports doesn't exist anymore as we know it.
Right.
But a real seat at the table in some form where you actually have a voice in things, I think that could result from this too and be a long-term improvement, much needed and long needed improvement.
So next segment, let's get hypothetical because we've talked about it. We've heard other coaches talk about this, about joining another conference for a season just so they can play. So let's talk about what would be a mega conference, making it based on performance, fan base, money, producing NFL talent. So we're going to discuss that next. Morning Drive, Justin Bradford, Joe Rexford, Marquise Munson, ESPN 102.5 The Game. And welcome back to Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Justin Bradford, Joe Rexford, Marquise Munson taking care of us behind the glass. And Joe, you knew that you could stream 102.5 The Game, right?
I did.
Yeah. There's so many options. I mean, you can download the Game Nashville app. You can enable the Alexa skill or Google Home and ask to play 102.5 The Game or live stream from our website, thegamenashville.com. Pretty handy.
And again, I have a new download in the family of the app.
That's great. One. There you go.
She shouldn't be listening now because school's in, right? Yeah.
Did you actually?
Has school started yet? No.
Did you remember to leave the headphones at home this time?
I mean, honestly, when you said that, I got to look in the bag.
Here's hoping. A little bit of an issue yesterday. Did you have to get ice cream for your young one?
Absolutely got the ice cream. And yes, it looks like I took the right headphones. Thank you for asking, there we Justin. Go. We're all good.
Just want to make sure. It's a school day. It's a school day. We got to get used to this again. So hypothetical now, because we've had some coaches saying they would be more than willing to play another conference, to join another conference. So I wanted to kind of discuss this, too, that if we're going to form a mega conference, which this has been discussed years ago, too, especially when you had the big expansions with the SEC and the Big Ten and the Pac-12. And so many different conferences just saying, hey, we're going to start grabbing. We want to be in different markets. Big Ten goes to Rutgers to try to get in the New York City metro area market. You have the SEC expanding even further as well. So a mega conference potentially could happen based on team performance, fan base, money, and producing NFL talent. So I think there's an obvious number one to start with, right?
Number one
team to start with if you're building this conference would be Alabama, I'm assuming, right?
Oh, okay.
I think Marquise would agree with that.
I guess. They're all right.
If I'm building, it depends on how long I'm building this conference for.
Well, that's the thing. If you're talking all this stuff, then because to me, number one, two things come to mind.
Sure.
Notre Dame.
Absolutely.
And Texas.
Yes.
If you want to talk about eyeballs and reach and fan base and
sure.
television potential. That's the thing. I mean, it was supposed to be the four 16s, right? The four mega 16s. And the Big Ten's big grand plan was Notre Dame and Texas in the Big Ten.
Can you imagine?
I mean, which is just stupid. It's, but, hey, I mean, that again, Rutgers is stupid too. And the thing is, you know, that was – TV was different. This is really before cord cutting – became
Absolutely.
A thing, right? But, I mean, the Rutgers thing, yeah, was purely a force your way into the New York cable market. That's purely what it was. I mean, we heard a lot about, like, Rutgers has excellent academics, and that was a nice thing to say out loud.
But we know what it's about.
Yeah.
Because that is the conference cupcake on the schedule.
Although, hey, the Rutgers men's basketball, women's basketball has been good. Men's basketball is now getting actually good. But
football-wise.
Yeah. They are what they are.
So another way you mentioned Texas in terms of spending. A lot of data at Georgia I know is up there as well. Ohio State, Penn State, those are up there with reach. But, yeah, I agree then. Top three, Notre Dame, Texas, and I think Alabama just because of what they've been producing as well.
Their performance
and their fan base. And I know I might get grief for this, but Michigan, even though their performance hasn't been there in terms of fan base – TV reach as well, and then money that they bring in for it absolutely is part of the discussion too.
Sure. So are we – you're talking about – we're not talking about a temporary whoever's left playing conference.
No, I'm just talking about –
we're talking about actual long-term, you know, and maybe the
– Very hypothetical.
I've always thought that at some point there was going to be more expansion, although I do think also this – pandemic and everything up
it's going to change everything.
You know, it might make it less likely down the road because it is kind of ridiculous, especially when you talk about money and budget. And now it's like, oh yeah, well, our soccer team is heading out to, you know, taking the 4-hour flight to play a conference game on a Tuesday. You know, I mean that is part of the of the ridiculousness of college sports that has taken place since the expansion.
So we do have a caller on the line. We have Brad wanting to respond to Booger's comments. Brad, welcome to the show.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm a long-time listener. I'm an old-timer. I'm 74 from Kansas originally. But I still teach full-time at an HBCU college in Jackson, Tennessee. And for Mr. McFarland to make the statement that there are no representatives for athletes in the NCAA is not correct. Every NCAA conference is required to have a student athlete activity or advisory group on their campus. I know because I've been the advisor for ours for the last 5 years.
Well, that's a good point, Brad.
Student athletes do have a voice, even though it's a small one. They have a voice in all legislation that comes up before the NCAA.
No, and that's a good point. I brought up the student advisory committees, Brad, and I'm glad that you called to talk about that. So is Brad gone?
Brad's gone.
Okay, sorry. Well, that's the thing, and he's right. They have these advisory committees, and actually I think that it's gotten better in somewhat recent years in terms of reaching out for that. I think, you know, leadership in college athletics has recognized that you should have some kind of a voice. I would argue, and I would actually like Brad's opinion on this, that they could have more of a voice, that they could have more impact. They do give input. That is true. But again, it's like with this movement with the players wanting to play, certainly the public opinion aspect of it, we've already seen that be impacted. But are they ultimately going to sway the presidents on that? I mean, can they actually, you know, they don't have a mechanism, and some sort of thing like a union would, something stronger than an advisory committee, I think is possible and would give them more of a voice.
Well, especially if thinking of more athletes collectively together instead of just a few, because then they know the voice is strong. So it's a good start. And then have more, to where they feel like there is power behind the message, and not just to say, to where it's not just part of, say, like your student government in colleges a lot of times too. You feel like, yeah, you're representing, but are you getting things done? But if you have a big collective body with a strong voice, with, you know, you have the public opinion backing you on this, or just the public in general, whether it's boosters or fans or whatnot backing what you're saying and believing that, it forces more change to happen. But it's a grassroots movement. Everything starts as grassroots, right? If you really want something to change, it starts as grassroots, whether that's in politics, in sports, and whatnot. Grassroots is if you something that you truly believe in, grassroots is that level. And the grassroots right now is on Twitter. We're seeing this from a lot of these student-athletes.
Sure.
It's a huge grassroots movement because, like we said before, you can't avoid seeing this. If you are into any sort of sports, even if it's not college football, but you follow a few people that talk sports, some journalists, it's getting retweeted into your timeline. You are seeing what these student-athletes are doing, future leaders in the NFL and what they're doing, folks that may not even have a future playing pro, but they want to play right now, that they have a voice and they have concern on so many different levels. And you have parents, you have former NFL players, former college athletes as well. You see more voices rise to the top, which is, I think, great for sports, that it's not just coaches, it's not just athletic directors, it's not just us as journalists and media representation. It's actually having the athletes that are playing the game feeling like they have a more powerful voice, especially amateurs that, as you said, have been pushed on. They're amateurs. They can't make money. They can't do this. But they feel like they have a powerful voice, as they should. Then it's not just, oh, well, they're amateur athletes. We're going to make the decision for them.
Exactly. And again, this is why pro sports now, we have free agency. We have things collectively bargained. Even NFL players, you know, may hate the Thursday games. And I think there's a real conversation to be had about the safety of Thursday games. But listen, they agreed to it, and there's a financial component to agreeing to things. So that's how it should be. It's a lot more complicated in college sports, but I think maybe we're moving there.
So before we have to go to break, back to the topic, because it's interesting to see budgets sometimes. Just looking at it, because you have an idea always, like you said, Notre Dame. We talked to Alabama, Texas, that we know of. But there's some schools that have big budgets that spend a lot of money, haven't necessarily matched up performance-wise.
I can think of one.
Go for it.
Well, I mean, I think Tennessee, certainly.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. Tennessee remains one of the absolute powers in college sports in terms of revenue. And a lot of terrific programs, too, beyond football. But football, of course, has not carried the weight in the last decade-ish or so.
Performance-wise. They're still putting out talent.
Oh, yeah. They still have
NFL,
talent.
Yeah.
I mean, you still, when you are pretty good at Tennessee, you pack the place there. I do think we've seen a little bit of apathy from the past few years, but
Robbie Stanley
sort of represents the growing apathy of some Tennessee fans. But, you know, there's also, look, you talk about this football season, you know, Tennessee has by all accounts done a great job controlling the virus. They've been working out. There's a lot of excitement about that team, and you know, they're out there working in those, and now it's like, it might just be like, okay, sorry, we're not playing. But yeah, to your point, Tennessee, still a power in college football financially, just not actually in the football. But hey, that was Alabama not that long ago.
Right.
I mean, 10 years ago, or you know, 14 years ago when Nick Saban got there, it had been a long time of Alabama being way underperforming.
Goes in waves. Sometimes those waves are longer between than others.
And then there's Michigan, and I'm waiting. I'm waiting for your Wolverines, Justin. Keep waiting.
I know. I'm gonna keep waiting. I have a feeling
they're good,
but they're not elite.
Yeah,
they're not elite, and they're not part of the conversation. Michigan is part of the conversation for about 2 weeks every football season, and then it's just fart noise.
Well, the preseason hype for Michigan is always ample.
Yeah, well, the talent somebody, on paper a lot of times is there.
But. I mean, they have the most September Heismans in maybe college football history.
I should probably end this segment before I dig myself into a hole with Joe. Up next, let's talk Major League Baseball. There's just St. Louis is having their issues. Miami has had their issues. What does that mean for the rest of the MLB season? That next, Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back to Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Justin Bradford, Joe Rexrode, Marquise Munson behind the glass. And switching gears a little bit here to talk some Major League Baseball, because it just seems like so many of those players not being able to keep it together and follow team rules, getting dismissed from teams, getting put into quarantine, going out for coffee, and Cardinals having to deal with it, the Marlins, the Indians. So many different teams are dealing with this. How is this going to affect the rest of the season? Because you have a Miami Marlins roster, which is what? Not the roster they're typically playing with, but they're actually doing well? What does this all mean, Joe?
Yeah. They're winning. They've been on an absolute tear since this whole thing with the virus. So maybe that was the key for them, you know? I mean, I don't,
clean house?
Yeah. Get some new blood in there. I don't know. But at least, I mean, baseball, obviously it's had some cancellations and things like that. There's still the larger concern about more things happening, more things being canceled. At what point are you canceling so much that you've already fundamentally changed what a baseball season is? And now, of course, there are discussions. This is Jeff Passan, ESPN, about, you know, this idea of a playoff bubble situation. I mean, it's pretty simple in sports these days. It's bubble good, no bubble bad. That's pretty much what we've seen so far. So maybe something like now, of course, the problem with baseball doing that this year is, like, you know, you're talking about 16 teams.
Right.
So that's big. But, again, I mean, the NHL just did it with 24 and two bubbles.
Right.
So you could do something like that. Postseason is supposed to start September 27th. I think if we go forward and there are more issues, I think that becomes more and more likely as a discussion, because baseball still wants to retain that postseason. I mean, really, this whole season is going to be that – it's that expanded postseason. It's just a weird for baseball because we're used to the 162 games really determining who your best teams are. But if you can preserve and hold on to that and make it safe and bubble it up, and by the way, it's already August 11th, so you might want to get working on that, then at least you don't ruin your postseason. You got to have your postseason.
And the Cardinals haven't played since July 29th. 2-3 on the season. 5 games, yet they're still above Pittsburgh in the division standings. Based on win percentage, because Pittsburgh's only won 3 and they've lost 13. Wow. So it's just interesting you say, because this is very different. And baseball had its opportunity to get started much earlier, too.
Oh, they just, question.
Which could be less of an asterisk-type season. Playing by playing more games, you're so used to, even if they got to what, 100, 120 even, you know, you're losing a lot of games, but you're still getting to a number where it's like, okay, you got your rotations in, you really see what a team is made of when it comes to this. But they couldn't get off the pot.
Well, that's the thing. We've just been talking about how important it would be for college athletes to be able to have a voice and negotiate, and it doesn't always work out right. For the pro leagues. It can be ugly. So, yeah, that baseball blew it. They had a month to themselves that they forfeited. But here's where they are. It is amazing that the Cardinals have played 5 games.
Yeah, it really is. And so for the Cleveland Indians, they sit pitcher Mike Clevinger after he violated the team rules in Chicago. You have players just violating team rules. What is it going to take for the professional athletes when you don't have a bubble situation to take team rules seriously? And whatever you think about what's going on here, too, a team rule is a team rule, right? That you should not be violating because they think this is the best possible way for you to have a season, for you to compete in the season, for you to be a part of this season, and is also your job. your job to follow these team rules that have been in place for you to successfully pull off the season. And you have players still not taking it seriously enough, whether you agree or disagree with how the handling of this has been a team rule, and they're sitting. What are people, what are they thinking about this? What are people thinking about this as well? Especially if you're a fan of a team and say, maybe it's a star that goes off and does this, that's supposed to be in the rotation, they're pitching the next day, but then they violate a team rule. You have fan dollars that are still being put into this, whether it's through TV, through merchandise, through purchasing their stand-up to be in the seats. There's still money coming in for all this as well. And so what is it going to take for professional athletes in baseball to take it seriously without there being a bubble?
See, I do think in baseball, anytime the baseball discussion comes up, it's then, okay, so then how does this make you feel about the NFL? How does the NFL look at this and think about what that's going to look like?
True.
I do think a big difference for baseball is that half of whatever your length of season is, your team's on the road. So they're on the road for like 10 days at a time. You know, football, you're going to travel to a city and you're going to do hotel stuff and do walkthroughs and you're going to play the game and fly right home. Baseball teams have a lot of time on the road. And even in this time, there are, you know, you can still go to bars. You can still go to restaurants. So I think like the temptation is much greater and the risk is much greater that baseball players will stray on one night like, man, I'm, you know, going to go get a couple beers, whatever it is. Whereas in football, also, I think, look, in football, if you want to compare the two, there's just a much greater risk of just being out of the league. You're trying to make a pension. You're trying to hold on to these careers that are discarded quickly. And I think there's a lot more, I think there will be a lot more compliance with football teams than baseball teams, because it's just, there's nothing like this where you are just go on these long road trips and you bounce around, which was another argument, by the way, for a bubble. So you sort of are just kind of, even though that would, like the guys in the NHL who were there all the way to the end, they're going to be playing for something big, so that keeps you going. But I bet you they'll be awfully sick of that bubble by the time they're out of it. So that's not easy, but if you keep the virus out, then, hey, it's a positive.
There's only so much free Tim Hortons in those NHL bubbles. That'll keep them happy. They appreciate it, I'm sure, and the little things like having pictures there of your family and having amenities like the TVs, video games, ping pong tables. That's great for probably the first few weeks. And then it's like you're going to have two teams that are there till October. So from end of July to the beginning of October. And it's not me complaining about them or anything, because they wanted to do this and they agreed to this. They thought this was the best possible way there to have these amenities as well. But that's a long time to be separated from your family. Now, granted, a lot of families going to be able to travel to the host cities
right
later on, because you have a lot less people there too. So that's going to be the test. I think that's the next big test for the NHL in terms of the bubbles there, is when families come. But I'm sure there's going to be rigorous testing involved there too. So now on the baseball side of it, on the NFL side of it, how's that going to go? And the good thing for the NFL is at least they've had hopefully time to prepare for this in terms of testing. They've been doing it already, been rigorous, and holding players and teammates accountable for things. That's the big thing, too, is that hold each other accountable.
Yeah.
They have to hold each other accountable. For this to be successful, they have to hold each other accountable.
Yeah, and Dennis Kelly is said to be very strong on that in terms of mask enforcement. But again, you also just have the randomness of going home and someone in your family went to get toilet paper. And that's the thing. I mean, if you don't have the bubble, you're just open to things that could be no one's fault.
Right.
No one's fault other than, I guess, like our fault in this country of not doing better with the virus. But that's – and then you get into where your teams are could impact a lot of things. I mean, it could impact the final result of the NFL season. You know, you could have 2-3 more losses on your record because like the virus is rampant in your city.
Then you had to forfeit a game, maybe.
Yeah, or you had to play with way reach deep down replacement players. Like, that's another thing too for me is like, if you have outbreaks and now you are hitting the waiver wire, what about the quarantining and the, you know, the assurances that people you're bringing in are fine? And this is where testing getting better and getting more rapid and more
exactly
and more accurate is so important, which again, also, if you want to talk about spring college football season, that Dabo Swinney says there's just nothing will change. even though I have no idea how he could possibly know that. If you had something like that with the testing, there's one improvement that would make a season
absolutely
more viable.
Up next, Mike Golic Jr. of ESPN is going to join us, talk more on college football, the landscape there, and get his opinions on how this is all being handled. That's up next, Morning Drive. Justin Bradford, Joe Rexroad, Marquise Munson, ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.